This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And we tell stories about everything here on this show, including your stories. Send them to OurAmericanStories.com. They are some of our favorites. Hair of the dog to paint the town red, the curious origins of everyday sayings and fun phrases, is a book that reveals the surprising, captivating, and even hilarious origins behind 400 of these sayings, including read between the lines, cat got your tongue, raining cats and dogs. Here with the recurring series is Hair of the Dog author Andrew Thompson as he shares another slice from his ultimate guide to understanding these baffling mini-mysteries of the English language.
The first expression I'd like to tell you about is above board, which means honest and open or legal. If something's above board, everything's okay. It reminds me, years ago I used to have a weekly game of blackjack with a group of guys, and people would often cheat. It was all a bit joking, but people would have their hands under the table and everyone would say, get your hands on the table, you've got to be above board. And that's where that expression comes from. It's a gaming expression. In card playing, the board was the table, as in a sideboard. And if a player dropped his hands below the table, he could be accused of cheating by swapping his cards or pulling a card out that he had stashed under there. So to stop any sort of suspicion, people had to keep their hands above the table. So if the player's hands are above board, nobody could suggest anything was wrong. A saying that comes from ancient times is Achilles' heel, which everyone's heard of. It means a weakness or vulnerability. You might say he's a great runner, but that's his Achilles' heel, when he can't do long distances, for example. It has its origins in ancient Greek legend. Achilles was dipped into a river by his mother in order to give him a skin of armour and make him invulnerable to his enemies. But she held him by the heel, which didn't get covered by the water and became a weak point for him. He became this great warrior, but his arch enemy, a guy called Paris, discovered his weakness and killed him by shooting an arrow through his heel. And Homer wrote about this in the Iliad, and the phrase became popular in the 19th century. The expression across the board means it applies to everyone. For example, the government might impose tax cuts across the board. Now, this phrase is from the sporting arena. It was coined in America in the early 1900s from horse racing. At the time, at race meets, a large board would display the odds of horses, and the odds were listed for a horse to win, place or show, which was to make third. And if a punter placed a bet across the board, he put an equal amount of money on the horse to finish first, second or third. So it was an across-the-board bet that applied to everything, every option. To add another string to your bow is another sporting expression, which comes from the sport of archery. And it started in medieval times, when in competitions, often men who were the best shot became widely popular when archery was very popular for fighting and exhibition sports. So never to be caught short, the best archers would add another string to their bow. They'd attach a second string at the top of the bow that was wound around the handle. If the first string snapped or was damaged, the archer had a backup string to get him out of trouble. And that's also how the expression second string came about. To add insult to injury is an expression that comes from the literary world. It dates way back to 25 BC and was from a writer from ancient Rome, and it was from the story of the bald man and the fly. In that story, a fly stings a bald man on the top of his head, and the man swats at the fly trying to kill it, but the fly moves away so that the man hits himself on the head as well. And the fly then remarks, all you've done is added insult to injury, which is where the expression comes from, to mean making an already bad situation even worse. The phrase began in 25 BC, didn't pass into English until about the mid-1700s. The saying against the grain comes from tradesmen. It means against the natural flow or opposed to one's normal inclination. It has its origins in woodwork and carpentry. When wood is planed, sawed or sanded along the grain, it results in a smooth finish, but when it's done across the grain, it tends to splinter or be rough. So working against the grain is also far more difficult, and that's where the expression came from. It was first used by Shakespeare in 1607. Everyone knows the expression to aid and abet, which is usually used in relation to criminals with a person helping or inciting someone in the commission of a crime. So you might be convicted of aiding and abetting a crime. It's got an interesting origin, this one. It's from the now outlawed sport, or if you could call it that, of bear baiting. The word abet is from a Norse word meaning to bite, and it was originally called bear abetting in the 14th century in England, where a hungry bear would be tethered to a pole in a pit and set upon by trained bulldogs. The dogs would bite the bear until it was killed, and often in doing so they'd suffer casualties or be very tired, and the owner would urge the dog to continue to keep the spectacle going. So it was said that he was abetting the dog to keep biting. And the phrase was coined in the 18th century to mean what it does today. To air your dirty laundry in public means to talk in public about private matters. And this expression came from Napoleon Bonaparte in 1814 when he was exiled to the island of Elba. He was forced to abdicate the French throne and he went there. And he, despite the island being surrounded by the British Navy, he managed to escape on a boat after less than a year there. And back in France, he was asked about his experiences on the island, to which he replied, "It is at home and not in public that one washes one's dirty linen." And that eventually got corrupted to air your dirty laundry in public to come to what it means today. All hell broke loose has become a common expression to mean wild and erratic behaviour. Like if a teacher left the classroom for 10 minutes, all hell broke loose with the students. It's got literary origins as well. It's from John Milton's epic poem Paradise Lost, which was published in 1667. And it tells the tale of the biblical Garden of Eden. In one part, just before he casts him out of the Garden of Eden, the angel Gabriel asks Satan why he travelled alone and hadn't been joined by other inhabitants of hell. And Gabriel poses the question as, "Wherefore with thee came not all hell broke loose?" Which is Old English, obviously, but that's where the expression began.
And a special thanks to Greg for producing the piece, and a special thanks also to Andrew Thompson. Hair of the Dog to Paint the Town Red is the book. Go to Amazon.com and buy it. The story of our own language and phrases we all know, but don't know the origins of, here on Our American Stories. Folks, if you love the great American stories we tell and love America like we do, we're asking you to become a part of the Our American Stories family. If you agree that America is a good and great country, please make a donation. A monthly gift of $17.76 is fast becoming a favorite option for supporters. Go to OurAmericanStories.com now and go to the donate button and help us keep the great American stories coming. That's OurAmericanStories.com. And we continue with Our American Stories. And this next story, well, it's a great social entrepreneurship story. And we often delineate between the two. Some people go into business to make money, but so much of the great work in this country is philanthropic work for the community and for the betterment of people's lives, filling the gaps. Well, that's what social entrepreneurship does. And this next story is brought to us by our own Joey Cortez.
Every kid is born curious, and we do a damn good job saying, don't climb on that, don't put that in your mouth. Of course, we have to put those guardrails up, but if you think about how we raise our kids, don't do this, don't do that, don't see this, don't. And what do kids want to do? Explore. They want to taste it, they want to touch it, they want to try it. And we do a good job for little kids, like trying to kill their curiosity, right?
You're listening to Nicole Small, an extraordinary Dallas woman who orchestrated the massive merger between Dallas's three then-existing science, natural history, and children museums, and became the head of the new Perot Museum. She must have caught some kind of science bug when working at Perot, because she now runs the If-Then Initiative, encouraging young girls to pursue careers in STEM, careers in science, technology, engineering, and math, by highlighting stories of inspiring women in STEM. But in truth, she didn't catch any science bug at all. She's had it since she was a little girl.
I grew up in Dallas. My father was at the medical school here, so I had this upbringing where I was exposed to a ton of science. What I didn't know then was that that would have a deep influence on my life. I think sports for me was a huge thing growing up. I mean, sports is just an incredible way that I think parents enable their kids to go out there. My parents always taught me, It's how you win and how you lose. That's integrity and character, right? And competition is really important because that's how you learn to fail sometimes. You cry and then you look around and you're like, no one else is crying. I better get up and keep going. And I got hurt playing high school soccer, made it to college, played 2 years in college, and I was a soccer player. That's like who I was and what I did. And my injury got a lot worse, and an orthopedic surgeon said to me, do you want to hike, bike, and ski the rest of your life, or you want to play another year or two of soccer? What's your trajectory? And I was like, well, but I'm a soccer player. That's like what I do. And he said, well, you better figure out how to do something else then, because this is, you're not going to be able to do all these things the rest of your life. And that was a pretty painful moment when everything you've worked for just kind of gets taken away. I think my parents felt sorry for me for about 5 minutes and said, okay, sorry, you've had a great run, that's awesome, but like, what are you gonna do about it now? And not in an unkind way by any means. You cannot change the past, you cannot change the situation, what are you gonna do about it? You'd make the best out of your situation, and so you move on with life, and like I said, it doesn't always go the way you plan it, and sometimes awesome things happen that are unplanned. So, graduated from college and I had an opportunity to go work for McKinsey & Company, which is a consulting firm, and got the greatest business education ever. Worked really hard, but in a good way. Everybody should understand what it means to work hard too, right? I had just the incredible good fortune to work for great people and great clients, and one of my projects was working for a natural history museum. I was the low man on the totem pole, and McKinsey had offered to do some pro bono work for a local natural history museum in Dallas, so they offered me up, and my job was to go look at museums and figure out what made a great science museum. We had in Dallas built a natural history museum at the Texas State Centennial in 1936, and we still had the exact same museum. Dallas had 250,000 people when that museum was built. Now we've got 6 or 7 million in our Metroplex area. The city had outgrown the museum, kind of what they'd say, Stones and Bones Museum. Well, we've got kids in the 21st century that learn everything on their phones, so you gotta think about how to stay competitive, right? It's like any other business. We like to say that nonprofit is a tax status, not a business plan. So for everybody who tries to run their business, you know, as a charity, it turns out you actually have to make money, no margin, no mission, right? So we had to figure out how to build an institution. They wanted to build an institution that actually, you know, could make money, could serve people, could make sure that they were meeting their mission, right? So, of inspiring the next generation. And like a typical consultant, I finished the deck, handed it to my partner, we presented it to the board at the museum and said, good luck. We hope you guys can go build a new museum one day. And I thought that was the end of it. But yet, that was just the beginning. I didn't know that.
Nicole went on to Northwestern's business school, where she started and sold her own company with classmates. She then made her way back to Dallas for love and for marriage, and unexpectedly made her way back to the Museum of Natural History.
They said, do you want to come help us build that museum you talked about? And I said, I don't know anything about museums, but I know how to start things. I can write business plans and I'll help consult for a while.
And a while turned into a while. 13 years, to be exact. This project was no small feat, and it metamorphosized into something far greater.
I was a young woman taking over an old natural history museum, and there were challenges for sure. So, I came in from a startup, from the for-profit world, and it took me some time to culturally adjust. Probably took people some time, they would tell you to culturally adjust me.
Business plans in hand and expectations to work long hours, Nicole came in like a bull in a china shop. But it turns out that with her background, she would be the perfect person to face the challenges ahead.
We had three museums in Dallas. There was a science center, a natural history museum, and a children's museum, who all had their own brands, had their own constituents. All of them wanted to go from good to great. And what we recognized was that our constituents would be better off if we had one great museum versus a few good ones. Some would tell you it took 10 years to get the merger done, and we spent a lot of time working to try to figure out how to encourage the teams of three different museums that it would be better off for our community, that it was actually better for the mission that the business was a single entity over time, that while we were all three nonprofits, you know, no margin, no mission. You can't survive as a business. You can't get your mission out the door. And if there was a way to combine the three together, we could have a stronger margin and then we could have a stronger mission. And we really wanted to aspire to build a from scratch brand new museum. And the only way that was gonna get done was if we did it together. We were better together. So we spent hours and hours and hours, and it was painful along the way. Someone at the time said this was as easy as merging Exxon and Microsoft, right? And they were three little tiny nonprofits, but it's hard because people are really passionate. But we got this merger done, and we had already bought some new lands, and we began to envision, gosh, if you could build a museum from scratch to meet sort of the 21st century needs of how you inspire the next generation workforce and get kids in the community passionate about science, and you make it fun and you make it engaging and you make it smart, what would that look like? We were able to construct an exhibition design team, an architecture team, a construction team that we put together, frankly, right before the 08 crash. And so imagine deciding you're gonna raise $200 million, buying an expensive piece of land on the edge of downtown Dallas, being well into that project, being into design documents with the Pritzker Prize winning architect who was incredible, Tom Main, to work with three exhibition design firms, and then the market, the bottom completely falls out of the market in the middle of it. We're dead in the water. There's no way. We're never gonna raise $200 million. It's impossible. And what we saw at that bottom was incredible hope, this incredible realization that if ever we needed to invest in our kids, if ever we needed to think about how the US was gonna remain competitive, we needed to make sure that this project kept going. I think you asked me earlier if I ever cried. I cried when I fell off the beam when I was 8, and I think I cried when the market crashed because I just thought, gosh, there went our dream. It's over. There's no way this will ever happen. But people really rallied, and I had the good fortune of witnessing that, you know, sometimes when you're challenged, that resilience thing, it's kind of real.
That resilience thing, it's kind of real. Nicole Smalls, who we're listening to, the co-founder of If Then Initiative and the former CEO of Perot Museum. More of this remarkable story, her story, here on Our American Stories. And we continue with Our American Stories and Nicole Small's story. We left off with the stock market crashing, casting doubts on this bold endeavor to merge Dallas's three main museums. But while their team weathered the storm, Nicole was about to enter darker territory.
Got diagnosed with breast cancer about a year before we opened the museum. Definitely a shocker. And had an incredible team of doctors who were able to put me through a year of treatment, chemo, radiation, all of the above, and saved my life. Made me ever more passionate about science and investing in science, and also, you know, put your priorities in order. Silver lining and all that, right, is you also see the great good in people when you go through tough things. That makes me want to cry more than being told I'm sick, is how grateful I was. I had friends flying in from my two business partners who I had started a company with, showed up many times, sat through chemo with me, college friends, high school friends, my kids' friends' moms who jumped in to help make sure my kids were fed or got where they needed to go. People were incredible, truly, truly incredible. Random acts of kindness were just, you know, and I feel very indebted, right, to whom much is given, much is expected, and that can be used in a lot of ways. And for me, in that circumstance, I was unfortunately the recipient of a yuck diagnosis, right? But I was a recipient of such incredible kindness that I will forever hope and aspire to be as good of a person as those people were to me and to my family. It really restores your faith in humanity if you ever think about losing it. To go through difficult things sometimes brings out the best in people. And so that was a pretty incredible thing. And I got to keep working, some days better than others. And God, that museum kept me going. My kids kept me going. My husband kept me going. And so, knock on wood. If you could see me, I'm knocking on wood. You can hear that. I really don't want to do that again. While I was at the museum, we had to buy land. And we were incredibly fortunate to be introduced to Lyda Hill. She was associated with the company that made the first gift to buy the land for the Perot Museum and was just really inspired by her passion and commitment to making the world a better place, to science. And I was just really taken with her spirit. And along the way, she was really, really involved in our committee to build the museum. So we worked together for about 10 years. And through the process of building museums, she became a member of the Giving Pledge, which the Warren Buffett, Bill Gates pledge to commit to give away a majority of your wealth to make the world a better place. And she was like, yeah, not only am I gonna take the pledge, I'm gonna give it all away. Oh, and by the way, I'm gonna do it all while I'm alive. Because it's not fun to do it after you're dead, so I might as well do it now. So she just got this incredible kind of character and spirit and integrity. She's also a breast cancer survivor and was incredibly supportive when I was ill. And when she'd first taken the Giving Pledge, I said, gosh, I'm in my dream job. I didn't know it was my dream job, but it was my dream job to run this museum. What an incredible privilege. And I said, but boy, helping you give your money away, that's a fun job for someone too. Not knowing that would, I would have that opportunity one day. So we visited and I had an opportunity to join her team and do a lot of the work that I've been doing at the museum, focusing on how to inspire the world around in science, but do it maybe with her and in support of her on even a larger scale, as she wants to give all her capital away, and her tagline was science is the answer, which is kind of awesome, right? So the privilege to come support her in helping do the philanthropy to make, the world a better place was an incredible personal opportunity. And by the way, I've been at the museum 13 years. Great institutions need leadership change too, right? It's like you don't want to be the quarterback that stays a little too long, is a little, overstays their welcome. And so I left to join our team in 2014 and been there 5 years. And it's been an incredible ride. So I worked for a museum for so long and talked to kids and watched how they interacted. And when we were building the Perot, we thought a lot about this idea of giving kids visibility into career opportunities. Because again, if you can't see it, you can't be it. It's not new news that we have a leaky pipeline for women in STEM. And so we began to really think about, are we tackling this women in science challenge in the right way? And again, you can look at the pipeline from little girls all the way up to Nobel laureates. It leaks the whole way. If you leave half of the brains on the table, are we solving the problems we need? Are we giving everyone the best opportunity? I mean, we're not, right? It's just inherent in problem solving that you want as many great minds trying to solve problems. And by the way, it's proven over and over that bringing a diverse set of skills and brains to the table gives you different perspectives. Imagine a little girl like me who always wanted to be a soccer player, but I was never gonna be a pro athlete, right? But if I knew I could work for the US women's soccer team and be an orthopedic surgeon or a data scientist and combine my love of science with my love of soccer, like how cool is that? I didn't know that was an option when I was growing up, right? What if you're into fashion and you found out that we just, interviewed the head of Persons who was explaining to us that, if you don't know the golden rule and the Fibonacci sequence, how can you design things, right? You have to know math to design. So if you're interested in fashion, by the way, you should probably study math. How do you measure to cut fabric? How do you think about that material science? So if you want to cure cancer one day, did you know that there's lots of jobs, right? You could be a research scientist, you could be a clinician, you could work for a pharma company. How many jobs are out there to cure, cancer one day? We have met so many cool, amazing, inspirational women. Some are 22, some are 82, some are, biochemists, some are marine biologists, some work for garden companies, for Google, all sorts of things, right? So we realized that if we could just show more little girls what their opportunities were, then we might be able to begin to widen the pipeline. So one of the things we noticed was, gosh, was there an opportunity to work with lots of different sectors to show little girls that STEM was everywhere, to both amplify the girls who were already interested in science to make sure they had visibility into what their options were, to girls who thought they weren't interested in science because they didn't know really what that meant. They were told they weren't good at math when they were little. They thought it wasn't for them. They thought being a scientist was only one thing, right? A lot of kids have a vision of the scientist and they draw Albert Einstein or they draw someone in a lab, which is incredible work, right? That's how we're curing cancer. But if you're a kid who likes to be outdoors all the time or likes to be in the ocean all the time, like maybe we should show them they could be a marine biologist one day. So we recognized that there was an opportunity to bring together thought leaders across sectors to create what we're calling the If-Then Initiative. If we support a woman in STEM, then she can change the world. This initiative is about inspiring young girls and connecting them to amazing role models, funding women in science, funding women scientists, and then helping them tell their stories. We're gonna have some badass women too that people are just like, I mean, not only do I wanna be her when I grow up, like I just wanna be friends with her because she's so fascinating and cool and interesting and real, right? The other thing about these women is they're real. So a lot of them have families, a lot of them are adventure scientists, a lot of them work in labs, a lot of them, some have won a Nobel Prize, some are gonna be 22-year-old postdocs that an 18-year-old could look at and say, oh, okay, I can see myself in her shoes because that's not that far away. So they're real, and we're gonna tell their real stories.
Real stories, and we do that here every day, and we know that the power of stories is the imitative power. We can see ourselves in the characters, and the more diverse those characters, the more people in America actually see themselves. If you can't see it, you can't be it, we heard Nicole Small say earlier. And so her life's mission is to bring more women to the sciences, to technology, engineering, and math, known as STEM. And you can see all of the great work of the If-Then Initiative at ifthenshecan.org. That's ifthenshecan.org. They have great stories of women in STEM that will be a tremendous resource for you, your children, and your community. This is Lee Habib, Nicole Small's story here on Our American Stories. This is Our American Stories, and we love to tell stories about just about everything, but particularly innovation and invention. And no country in history has done it like we have. Up next, the story of light, and in particular, how Thomas Edison got to the point of his first public display of light. Here to help tell the story is our own Monty Montgomery and the folks at the Thomas Edison Center, not far from where I grew up. Take it away, Monty.
Thomas Edison's story began in the Midwest, where, astoundingly, he only had 12 weeks of formal education. Here's Kathleen Carlucci and Russ Garam of the Thomas Edison Center at Menlo Park with more.
His mother basically taught him, and he had a love of reading. And he didn't, I mean, of course, science is his favorite subject, but he had a huge interest in literature and just learning about everything. You know, this is the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. And so he was seeing so many new things popping up, and he was really encouraged by his parents. I mean, he made a lot of mistakes. He burns down the family barn, creating chemical experiments. I don't know where that curiosity came from, but it was almost like a hunger that he had to feed. At the age of 21, he would create his first patent for a vote recording machine. And no one wanted to buy it. It worked, but they didn't want to have quick voting. He was told by the legislature that they didn't want a machine to make voting go quicker. They needed to filibuster and discuss issues and try to win the other side onto their side. So it was a commercial failure at that time. Edison had put all of his resources into this invention. He had quit his job because he wanted to just be an inventor. And so one of his friends offered him a job with the Golden Stock Indicator Company, a division of Western Union, in New York City. So by the time Edison got the funds together to take a steamship from Boston to New York, the job, the position were no longer open. But very shortly thereafter, Edison would save the day and a broken stock ticker would be repaired by him. And the president of the company, William Orton, said, hire him. William Orton took a special interest in Thomas Edison. He really saw something in him and really developed a strong belief that this gentleman, this young man, could really do things and go places. So he had an idea that, you know, Edison, how about if you work for me creating improvements on my telegraph systems or my stock ticker systems, and I'll supply you with the money, the men, the space. And Edison thought that was a great idea because it's always been his dream. And so he would partner with his good friend that had invited him to come to New York, Franklin Pope, and together they would create what we know today as the universal stock ticker. And Edison would be offered quite a bit of money for that patent, he and Pope. And Edison decided to venture out on his own. And that's basically how he came to New Jersey,
where he would found one of his major bases of operation, Menlo Park.
Menlo Park was actually a failed housing development. He'll be his most prolific at Menlo Park, creating over 400 original patents with a team of workers, and he would dub this site the Invention Factory. And so Menlo Park would be known as the birthplace of R&D, and Edison would become known as the Wizard of Menlo Park. What he creates here is a team approach to research. He is a very gifted chemist, but he can't do everything, so he hires chemists. He hires engineers, blacksmiths, physicists, and they work together. Edison would say, this is what I want to do. They would meet as a team in the laboratory, and then they would break out to the respective buildings of what they had to do. They would come back together. They didn't just think of ideas. They created ideas, put them into motion, and then improved on them.
So more or less, Edison has the original innovation campus, the likes of which you see at Google today. And one of their biggest tasks was working with incandescent light, which was in its infancy and dominated by the arc lighting meta.
Arc lighting was so bright. It was put in, I had read that it was put in the Louvre in Paris, and the artists were appalled because it washed the color away from their paintings, and they weren't as nice as they should have been. They weren't what they are in daylight. And Edison sees that, and it's like, you know, silly to say, but it's like a light bulb goes off in his head. He says, I think I can figure out what the problem is with this in 3 days. Well, he comes back to his laboratory, and of course it doesn't take him 3 days or 3 months. It takes him, between like 18 and 21 months to work on it.
Edison would test over 6,000 different filaments until finding the best working one. And on January 27, 1880, Edison would patent his light bulb, which fundamentally changed things for the world.
You know, you got to think about when he grew up, you had candles and kerosene lanterns, and life basically shut down when the sun went down. And he opens up this whole world for people.
It wasn't as polluting. Don't forget the big cities where there was a lot of industry and things. There was a lot of smog, and this was caused by the boilers and the coal-burning steam engines. But Edison saw past that, and he saw that electric trains would be the future. He just saw that electricity could improve everyone's lot.
It was also pleasing to look at.
It's like candle power, and that's actually how they measured its glow at that time. It was measured in candle power, just like people measure cars and horsepower still today. And it was really quite beautiful. You know, We tell, you know, a lot of our visitors here, think about a candle. Like, if you turn all the electric lighting off and you have a candle burning on your table, it lights the vicinity like a round circle. You can't see under the table very well with that. You can't see behind furniture with that. Yet if you have one light bulb in a room and you turn it on, it's like the light is everywhere. It's a beautiful glow.
But before Edison patented it in 1880, he needed investors to make sure it was commercially viable. So Edison would have to put it on display for the world to see, and on December 31st, 1879, he would do just that at Menlo Park.
Well, he needed investors. You know, he wanted to light like a square mile of Manhattan, you know, right around the Wall Street area, so he could get investors to build this system, the Edison Electric Company. He wanted to show that this was the future. He put out invitations through the newspapers, sent out letters, and people came here from all over the world for even a few years after the first demonstration. His backers, financial backers, they didn't actually want him to do that demonstration on New Year's Eve 1879 because sometimes it wasn't working, you know, all the time. And they didn't want to show something and then it didn't work. I mean, that's always an inventor, their worst nightmare. But Edison had faith in his system, and he didn't just light, you know, like one building. He lit many buildings and an entire street, Christie Street, and it really captures the imagination. It was beautiful. It was like Edison turned night into day. And it created such a fever of people wanting to see it that the Pennsylvania Railroad had to add on extra runs so people could drive by or come and see Menlo Park lit. It was such an anomaly, and it was spectacular.
Today, light is something we often don't think much about. It's just there. And today, it might seem strange to us that for 2 years, people would take a train out to Menlo Park just to see the lights. But you have to remember, Edison truly lived in an age of invention, and the change that happened in his life was astounding to everybody.
One of my docents, actually Russ here, has mentioned many times that when Edison was a young boy in Port Huron, Michigan, he was watching the Conestoga wagons moving out to open up the West. And then later on, he'll be very good friends with the Wright brothers. He sees man fly. I mean, the breadth of innovation and invention during that time period is unbelievable.
And great work, as always, by Monty Montgomery. And a special thanks to Kathleen Carlucci and Russ Garam. The story of Thomas Edison, the story of the first public display of light here on Our American Stories.